that's all I am. Singing in this ghetto town. Yes, I am. I'm just a ghetto man. That's all I am. Living in this ghetto town. Baby, please remember this. Diamond ring, I can't give you. No, I can't. Because I only made a few ghetto plans. And they don't include diamond rings, honey. A whole lot of money I can't give you. No, I can't. Because I only made a few ghetto plans. Yes, I did. That's the reason why. Oh, I'm looking. I got to keep looking. For me a ghetto woman, I know she'll understand. A new car I can't give you. I can't afford it, baby. Because I only made a few ghetto plans. And they don't include a new car, honey. A whole lot of things that a girl should have, I can't give. Because I made ghetto plans. Yes, I did. But if it's love you're looking for, I want you to come on, come on, and let me love you. Baby, please remember this. I'm just a ghetto man. I don't have much. Because I made ghetto plans. But I'm willing to share with you, honey. If it's love, love you're looking for, I want you to come on. Let me take you to my paradise. Let me be your man, baby. But remember, I'm just a ghetto man. That's all I am. Singing in this ghetto town. I just want to remind you one more time, baby. I'm just a ghetto man. Baby, I can't give you a lot of things. Because I made ghetto plans. Don't you ever forget that, baby. Whoa, oh, oh, I'm a ghetto man. Have much, but I'm willing to share with you.
You see, baby, most men can give you a whole lot of things, but I'm just playing on Marvin, baby. You see, I don't live in Hollywood or London or Paris or Rome. You see, baby, I live right here. I can't afford to eat the best of food. Sometimes I eat beans out of a can. So if you don't mind that,
come on. But remember, I'm just a ghetto man. That's all I am. Living in this ghetto town. Don't you ever forget that, baby. I'm a ghetto man. I work hard for what I got, girl. Can I say it one more time, baby? Girl, oh girl, I'm just a ghetto man.
in Lord above, God Almighty, God of love, please look down and see my people too.
See my people too.
You're listening to CKLN. This is Saturday Morning Live, and we're going to conclude today's show with a speech by El Hajj Malik El Shabazz. This was a speech he made in Detroit, Michigan in November of 1963, and he made it at the it was supposed to be made at Aretha Franklin's father's church, but some contradictions took place, and he held it someplace else. And if we get to into the speech, you can hear people in the background. General Gordon Baker is hollering and screaming in the background. General Gordon Baker, who was a co-founder of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, he's now a member of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. And this is a message to the grassroots. This was a speech Malcolm made just before he left the Nation of Islam. And I would like to thank Joel for teching today. I would also like to thank Jackie, the station manager, for hooking me up with Joel. I would also like to thank Abayumi Azikiwe of the Pan-African Newswire, Dr. William Watkins of the University of Illinois at Chicago. I would like to thank the Gorilla Crew, Ome Raham Tula. I'd like to thank Tandewe Shimaranga of the All African People's Revolutionary Party, and Mumia Abu-Jamal and Melinda Francis. And we're going to end this portion of the show, or we're going to end the show with a speech by El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz. And El-Hajj Malik El-Shabazz would have been 86 years old on May the 19th of this year. This is the voice of Malcolm X.
And during the few moments that we have left, we want to have just an off-the-cuff chat between you and me, us. We want to talk right down to earth in a language that everybody here can easily understand. We all agree tonight, all of the speakers have agreed, that America has a very serious problem. Not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is us. We're her problem. The only reason she has a problem is she doesn't want us here. And every time you look at yourself, be you black, brown, red, or yellow, a so-called Negro, you represent a person who poses such a serious problem for America because you're not one. Once you face this as a fact, then you can start plotting a course that will make you appear intelligent instead of unintelligent. What you and I need to do is learn to forget our differences. When we come together, we don't come together as Baptists or Methodists. You don't catch hell because you're a Baptist, and you don't catch hell because you're a Methodist. You don't catch hell because you're a Methodist or a Baptist. You don't catch hell because you're a Democrat or a Republican. You don't catch hell because you're a Mason or an Elk. And you sure don't catch hell because you're an American, because if you was an American, you wouldn't catch no hell. You catch hell because you're a black man. You catch hell. All of us catch hell for the same reason. So we are all black people, so-called Negroes, second-class citizens, ex-slaves. You are nothing but an ex-slave. You don't like to be told that. But what else are you? You are ex-slave. You didn't come here on the Mayflower. You came here in a slave ship. In chains, like a horse or a cow or a chicken. And you were brought here by the people who came here on the Mayflower. You were brought here by the so-called pilgrims or founding fathers. They were the ones who brought you here. We have a common enemy. We have this in common. We have a common oppressor, a common exploiter, and a common discriminator. So once we all realize that we have this common enemy, then we unite on the basis of what we have in common. And what we have foremost in common is that enemy, the white man. He's an enemy to all of us. I know some of you all think that some of them are enemies. Time will tell. In Bandung, back in, I think, 1954, was the first unity meeting in centuries of black people. And once you study what happened at the Bandung Conference and the results of the Bandung Conference, it actually serves as a model for the same procedure you and I can use to get our problem solved. At Bandung, all the nations came together. There were dark nations from Africa and Asia. Some of them were Buddhists. Some of them were Muslim. Some of them were Christian. Some of them were Confucianists. Some were atheists. Despite their religious differences, they came together. Some were communists, some were socialists, some were capitalists. Despite their economic and political differences, they came together. All of them were black, brown, red, or yellow. The number one thing that was not allowed to attend the Bandung Conference was the white man. He couldn't come. Once they excluded the white man, they found that they could get together. Once they kept him out, everybody else fell right in and fell in line. This is the thing that you and I have to understand. And these people who came together didn't have nuclear weapons. They didn't have jet planes. They didn't have all of the heavy armaments that the white man has. But they had unity. They were able to submerge their little petty differences and agree on one thing. That though one African came from Kenya and was being colonized by the Englishmen, and another African came from the Congo and was being colonized by the Belgian, and another African came from Guinea and was being colonized by the French, and another came from Angola and was being colonized by the Portuguese. When they came to the Bandung Conference, they looked at the Portuguese and at the Frenchmen and at the Englishmen and at the other Dutchmen and learn or realize that the one thing that all of them had in common, they were all from Europe. They were all Europeans, blonde, blue-eyed, and white-skinned. They begin to recognize who their enemy was. The same man that was colonizing our people in Kenya was colonizing our people in the Congo. The same one in the Congo was colonizing our people in South Africa and in southern Rhodesia and in Burma and in India and in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. They realized all over the world where a dark man was being oppressed, he was being oppressed by the white man. Where the dark man was being exploited, he was being exploited by the white man. So they got together under this basis, that they had a common enemy. And when you and I here in Detroit and in Michigan and in America, who have been awakened today, look around us, we too realize here in America, we all have a common enemy. Whether he's in Georgia or Michigan, whether he's in California or New York, he's the same man. Blue eyes and blonde hair and pale skin. Same man. So what we have to do is what they did. They agreed to stop quarreling among themselves. Any little spat that they had, they'd settle it among themselves. Go into a huddle. Don't let the enemy know that you got a disagreement. Instead of us airing our differences in public, we have to realize we're all the same family. And when you have a family squabble, you don't get out on the sidewalk. If you do, everybody calls you uncouth, unrefined, uncivilized, savage. If you don't make it at home, you settle it at home. You get in the closet, argue it out behind closed doors. And then when you come out on the street, you pose a common front, a united front. And this is what we need to do in the community and in the city and in the state. We need to stop airing our differences in front of the white man. Put the white man out of our meeting, number one, and then sit down and talk shop with each other. That's all you got to do. I would like to make a few comments concerning the difference between the Black Revolution and the Negro Revolution. There's a difference. Are they both the same? And if they're not, what is the difference? What is the difference between a Black Revolution and a Negro Revolution? First, what is a revolution? Sometimes I'm inclined to believe that many of our people are using this word revolution loosely, without taking careful consideration what this word actually means and what its historic characteristics are. When you study the historic nature of revolution, the motive of a revolution, the objective of a revolution, and the result of a revolution, and the methods used in a revolution, you may change words. You may devise another program. You may change your goal and you may change your mind. Look at the American Revolution in 1776. The that revolution was for what? For land. How was it? Why did they want land? Independence. How was it carried out? Bloodshed. Number one, it was based on land. The basis of independence. And the only way they could get it was bloodshed. The first revolution, what was it based on? The landless against the landlord. What was it for? Land. How did they get it? Bloodshed. Was no love lost. Was no compromise. Was no negotiation. I'm telling you, you don't know what a revolution is. Because when you find out what it is, you'll get back in the alley. You'll get out of the way. The moment, the Russian Revolution, what was it based on? Land. The landless against the landlord. How did they bring it about? Bloodshed. You haven't got a revolution that doesn't involve bloodshed. And you're afraid to bleed. I said you're afraid to bleed. Long as the white man sent you to Korea, you bled. He sent you to Germany, you bled. He sent you to the South Pacific to fight the Japanese, you bled. You bleed for white people. But when it comes time to seeing your own churches being bombed and little black girls murdered, you haven't got no blood. Bleed when the white man says bleed. You bite when the white man says bite. And you bark when the white man says bark. I hate to say this about us, but it's true. How are you going to be nonviolent in Mississippi as violent as you were in Korea? How can you justify being nonviolent in Mississippi and Alabama when your churches are being bombed and your little girls are being murdered? And at the same time, you're going to get violent with Hitler and Tojo and somebody else that you don't even know. If violence is wrong in America, violence is wrong abroad. If it's wrong to be violent, defending black women and black children and black babies and black men, then it's wrong for America to draft us and make us violent abroad in defense of her. And if it is right for America to draft us and teach us how to be violent in defense of her, then it is right for you and me to do whatever is necessary to defend our own people right here in this country. The Chinese Revolution. They wanted land. They threw the British out, along with the Uncle Tom Chinese. Yeah, they did. They set a good example. When I was in prison, I read an article, and don't be shocked when I say I was in prison. You're still in prison. That's what America means, prison. When I was in prison, I read an article in Life magazine showing a little Chinese girl, 9 years old, her father was on his hands and knees, and she was pulling the trigger because he was an Uncle Tom Chinaman. When they had the revolution over there, they took a whole generation of Uncle Tom, just wiped them out. And within 10 years, that little girl became a full-grown woman. No more Toms in China. And today is one of the toughest, roughest most feared countries on this earth by the white man. Because there are no Uncle Toms over there. Of all our studies, history is best qualified to reward all research. And when you see that you got problems, all you have to do is examine the historic method used all over the world by others who had problems similar to yours. And once you see how they got theirs straight, then you know how you can get yours straight. Please. There's been a revolution, a black revolution, going on in Africa. In Kenya, the Mau Mau were revolutionaries. They were the ones who made the word Uhuru. They were the ones who brought it to the fore. The Mau Mau, they were revolutionaries. They believed in scorched earth. They knocked everything aside that got in their path. And their revolution also was based on land, a desire for land. In Algeria, the northern part of Africa, a revolution took place. The Algerians were revolutionists. They wanted land. France offered to let them be integrated into France. They told France to hell with France. They wanted some land, not some France. And they engaged in a bloody battle. So I cite these various revolutions, brothers and sisters, to show you, you don't have a peaceful revolution. You don't have a turn-the-other-cheek revolution. There's no such thing as a nonviolent revolution. Only kind of revolution that's nonviolent is the Negro Revolution. The only revolution based on loving your enemy is the Negro Revolution. The only revolution in which the goal is a desegregated lunch counter, a desegregated theater, a desegregated park, and a desegregated public toilet. You can sit down next to white folks on the toilet. That's no revolution. Revolution is based on land. Land is the basis of all independence. Land is the basis of freedom, justice, and equality. The white man knows what a revolution is. He knows that the black revolution is worldwide, in scope, and in nature. The black revolution is sweeping Asia, sweeping Africa. It's rearing its head in Latin America. The Cuban Revolution, that's a revolution. They overturned the system. Revolution is in Asia. Revolution is in Africa. And the white man is screaming because he sees revolution in Latin America. How do you think he'll react to you when you learn what a real revolution is? You don't know what a revolution is. If you did, you wouldn't use that word. A revolution is bloody. Revolution is hostile. Revolution knows no compromise. Revolution overturns and destroys everything that gets in its way. And you sitting around here like a knot on the wall saying, I'm going to love these folks no matter how much they hate me. No, you need a revolution. Whoever heard of a revolution where they lock arms, as Reverend Cleve was pointing out beautifully, singing, We Shall Overcome. Just tell me, you don't do that in a revolution. You don't do any singing, you're too busy swinging. based on land. A revolutionary wants land so he can set up his own nation, an independent nation. These Negroes aren't asking for no nation. They're trying to crawl back on the plantation. When you want a nation, that's called nationalism. When the white man became involved in a revolution in this country against England, what was it for? He wanted this land so he could set up another white nation. That's white nationalism. The American Revolution was white nationalism. The French Revolution was white nationalism. The Russian Revolution, too, yes, it was white nationalism. You don't think so? Why you think Khrushchev and Mao can't get their heads together? White nationalism. All the revolutions that's going on in Asia and Africa today are based on what? Black nationalism. A revolutionary is a black nationalist. He wants a nation. I was reading some beautiful words by Reverend Cleve pointing out why he couldn't get together with someone else here in the city. Because all of them were afraid of being identified with black nationalism. If you're afraid of black nationalism, you're afraid of revolution. And if you love revolution, you love black nationalism.
To understand this, you have to go back to what young brother here referred to as the house Negro and the field Negro, back during slavery. There was two kinds of slaves. There was the house Negro and the field Negro. The house Negro, they lived in the house with master. They dressed pretty good. They ate good because they ate his food before he left. They lived in the attic or the basement, but still they lived near their master. And they loved their master more than the master loved himself. They would give their life to save their master's house quicker than the master would. The house Negro, if the master said, we got a good house here, the house Negro said, yeah, we got a good house here. Whenever the master said we, he said we. That's how you can tell a house Negro. If the master's house caught on fire, the house Negro would fight harder to put the blaze out than the master would. If the master got sick, the house Negro would say, what's the matter, boss? We sick. We sick. He identified himself with his master more than his master identified with himself. And if you came to the house Negro and said, let's run away, let's escape, let's separate, that house Negro would look at you and say, man, you crazy. What you mean separate? Where is there a better house than this? Where can I wear better clothes than this? Where can I eat better food than this? That was that house Negro. In those days, he was called a house nigger. And that's what we call him today because we still got some house niggers running around here. This modern house Negro loves his master. He wants to live near him. He'll pay three times as much as the house is worth just to live near his master. And then brag about, I'm the only Negro out here.
I'm the only one on my job. I'm the only one in this school. You're nothing but a house Negro. And if someone come to you right now and say, let's separate, you say the same thing that the house Negro said on the plantation. What's what you mean separated? From America? This good white man? Where you gonna get a better job than you get here? I mean, this is what you say. I ain't left nothing in Africa. That's what you say. Why, you left your mind in Africa. On that same plantation, there was the field Negro. The field Negro, those were the masses. There was always more Negroes in the field than there was Negroes in the house. The Negro in the field caught hell. He ate leftovers. In the house, they ate high up on the hog. The Negro in the field didn't get nothing but what was left of the insides of the hog. They call them chitlins nowadays. In those days, they call them what they were, guts. That's what you were, a gut eater. And some of you are still gut eaters. The field Negro was beaten from morning till night. He lived in a shack, in a hut. He wore cast-off clothes. And he hated his master. I say he hated his master. He was intelligent. That house Negro loved his master. But that field Negro, remember, they were in the majority. And they hated his master. When the house caught on fire, he didn't try and put it out. That field Negro prayed for a wind, for a breeze. When the master got sick, the field Negro prayed that he died. If someone come to the field Negro and said, let's separate, let's run, he didn't say, where are we going? He said, any place is better than here. You got field Negroes in America today. I'm a field Negro. The masses are the field Negroes. When they see this man's house on fire, you don't hear these little Negroes talking about our government is in trouble. They say the government is in trouble. Imagine a Negro, our government. I even heard one say our astronauts. They won't even let him near the plant. And our astronauts, our Navy, that's a Negro that's out of his mind. That's a Negro that's out of his mind. Just as the slave master in that day used Tom, the house Negro, to keep the field Negroes in check. The same old slave master today has Negroes who are nothing but modern Uncle Tom. 20th century Uncle Tom's, to keep you and me in check, keep us under control, keep us passive and peaceful and nonviolent. That's Tom making you nonviolent. It's like when you go to the dentist and the man is going to take your tooth. You're going to fight him when he starts pulling. So they squirt some stuff in your jaw called Novocaine. To make you think they're not doing anything to you. So you sit there and, coach, you got all that Novocaine in your jaw, you suffer peacefully. Blood running all down your jaw. And you don't know what's happening. Because someone has taught you to suffer peacefully. The white man do the same thing to you in the street. When he don't want to put knots on your head and take advantage of you and don't have to be afraid of you fighting back. To keep you from fighting back, you get these old religious Uncle Toms to teach you and me that just like Novocaine, suffer peacefully. Don't stop suffering, just supper peacefully. As Reverend Cleve pointed out, let your blood flow in the streets. This is a shame. And you know, he's a Christian preacher. If it's a shame to him, you know what it is to me. There's nothing in our book, the Quran, as you call it, Koran, teaches us to suffer peacefully. Our religion teaches us to be intelligent, be peaceful, be courteous, obey the law, respect everyone. But if someone puts his hand on you, send them to the cemetery. That's a good religion. In fact, that's that old-time religion. That's the one that Ma and Pa used to
say a lot. I think most like his work, a lot really resent his work. Genre film fans who are familiar with a lot of the film specifics that he references in movies like Kill Bill 1 and 2 will point out things like references to Lady Snowblood and whatever. There's a whole myriad of films that he references.
And it goes all the way back.
It goes Christina Lindbergh.
It goes all the way back to his first film, I mean, which references Ringo Lam's City on Fire.
Well, in that case, you know, you could make a case that he actually just outright kind of ripped off the story, but it's Reservoir Dogs is a vastly superior film to City on Fire. But basically, Tarantino, his kind of homages, his references, his even his outright scene stealing, can be best thought of as colours in his artist's palette. Because it's how he crafts his films. It's how he plays with audience expectations. It's how he weaves the elements together. It's how he writes his dialogue. It's how he gets inside the dramatic underpinnings of a scene. It's how he plays with the narrative sequences of a movie. He not only references specifics on other films, he references entire movements, entire philosophies, and he weaves it all together in this kind of complicated, very idiosyncratic tapestry. Tarantino makes Tarantino movies. I think of any of the American directors of the past decade, he's put the most personality in any one of his films. And I gotta tell you, consistently, his entire body of work in the past decade pretty much comprised the most exciting theatrical experiences I had in the cinema. From the Kill Bill movies to Grindhouse, which was woefully underappreciated. Basically, people went to see the film, thought it was fantastic, collectively, the two films together, and the whole night with the fake movie trailers and everything. It was wonderful. I don't know if you got to see Grindhouse.
I loved it. It was fantastic. As a complete experience, it was fantastic.
Yeah, I went back and saw it again twice. And we're lucky because then they did a terrible thing because it performed so poorly at the box office. They chopped the films in two and released them individually elsewhere. Unfortunately, they released them in countries where the whole Grindhouse concept probably would have played better. Unfortunately, the films just tanked everywhere. It was one of the most woeful situations of the past decade. But then he bounced right back with Inglourious Basterds, which is arguably one of his best films. Certainly has some of the best elements he's ever concocted in cinema, especially that opening sequence.
The opening sequence is fantastic.
With Christoph Waltz.
Yep.
And just the audacity of Inglourious Basterds. He defies all sort of genre conventions and rules, and he moves from one genre to another. And while he's at it, he rewrites history. It's almost an admission that cinema can never approximate history. That even if you try to be as faithful as possible to historical facts, it's still a fiction. So he doesn't even pretend to believe in that fallacy. It's a phenomenal film. It's a wonderful love letter to movies in general. Robert Richardson's cinematography, the performances. And I think Tarantino consistently writes great parts for great actors, often woefully underused and even forgotten actors.
And I think if a word can be properly attributed to Quentin Tarantino, I think Cinephobiac is probably
He's a cinephobiac. There's no question about it. So congratulations, Michael Moore and Quentin Tarantino. Cinephobiacs of the decade. All right, three left. Another big one. Chone of the decade.
Okay, so do we have any nominees for Chone of the Decade?
Not quite nominees, but I guess somebody who I would consider to be a runner-up.
Do you want to mention him now or after?
Yeah, I'm not splitting the award.
Okay.
Because the Chone of the Decade really was the Chone of the Decade, and it would be terrible to dilute the award. But I will tell you that this person's latest effort, had it come out in the past decade, there'd be no question in my mind he would be winning Chone of the Decade. But it's not right to usurp the rightful Chone of the Decade because of the crimes the other guy made in this decade.
Okay, who's the runner-up?
The runner-up is Michael Bay.
Okay.
The guy behind Platinum Dunes, the company that have just been raping and pillaging and defiling some of the greatest horror films ever made, with a slew of despicable remakes that are collectively crimes of the imagination. And had his Nightmare on Elm Street debacle took place in the last decade, no question, he'd win the award. But he squeaks out of the firing zone because of a calendar discrepancy.
A calendar discrepancy, and we've got another defiler, presumably, as the winner here. So should we get on
with
it?
Let's get right to the results.
Okay. The first annual Glass Ball Award for Chone of the Decade is... Ooh, George Lucas.
George Lucas, is there anybody else more deserving of this award? All he achieved, I mean, unfortunately, it would have been beautiful if all of the prequels would have taken place in the last decade, but the first one actually snuck in at the end of the 90s, but that doesn't change anything. I mean, Attack of the Chones alone would have guaranteed this guy Chone of the Decade Award. The fact that that's combined with, what was the third one?
Does it matter? What was it called?
Return of the Jedi? No. Revenge of the Sith? Is that right?
Is that what it is?
Yeah. Whatever. That's just adding insult to injury or whatever. It's the cherry on the top of the ice cream sundae.
The final insult.
There is nobody more deserving of Chone of the Decade. This is a guy who, in the 70s, created one of the most incredible experiences in cinema history. The story behind Star Wars is phenomenal. It's a work of inspiration, and it was a valiant battle he fought to bring to life a vision that nobody believed in, and he had to fight elements, the weather, the location, a snobby British crew, a lack of financing, special effects problems. All the way down the line, he ended up in hospital, but he brought it all back, put Star Wars up on the big screen with that John Williams score, one of the most beautiful, operatic, majestic experiences in cinema. It created entire childhoods, launched a whole new generation of film fans and filmmakers. His legacy is monumental. The series is iconic.
And then 20 years later...
to defile his own legacy, his own mythology, to the level that he did with those prequels, is a crime against cinema.
And I have to add that he wasn't satisfied in defiling one great cinematic corpse, Star Wars. He also had to tie on another one by flushing Indiana Jones down the toilet
as well. Oh, that's right, yeah. Technically,
oh, yeah.
Snuck in at the end of the decade. Yeah. Oh my god, I didn't even think about that. That's what I mean. Attack of the Chones on its own would have got him the award. Congratulations, George Lucas.
So we've got two awards left.
We got two awards left. Now, these are important awards.
Okay.
We've just celebrated and paid tribute to the previous decade.
Okay.
But I don't just want to acknowledge the previous decade. I want to go all the way back, pretty much. I want to honour the past century. Now, of course, we're not going to get into different films, blah, 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 a million different considerations. I'm just going to boil it down to two categories. Cinephobiac of the 20th century and Chone of the 20th century.
Okay.
You know, so that's we have a context. Okay. As we move forward into this current decade, we're putting the past behind us. We're putting the past into perspective. So I think it's only right that we honour the Cinephobiac and the Chone who most define the 20th century culture of cinema.
Okay, so what's the next category? Do you want to end on an upbeat note?
So we should start with the Chone and on an upbeat note with Cinephobiac?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I'm a very negative guy. We're going to do it the other way around. We'll do Cinephobiac and we're going to end with Chone.
All right, so let's get on with...
Let's get on with the Cinephobiac of the 20th century.
The winner of the first annual Glass Ball Award for Cinephobiac of the Century is... We have another tie.
Another tie.
Okay. The first winner is Ray Harryhausen. He's still alive, too, isn't he?
He is still alive. That's part of the consideration for why he deserves the award, because he's still alive to receive it. And you got to think, for Mr. Harryhausen, to this late in his life, to actually be honoured with a Glasball Award, what an incredible, incredible achievement.
I know that you're a great admirer of his work. You've had him on the show. I get that. But what would be the reason if people, like, give it to me quick, why him? For this award, why?
Well, I was going to get into that.
Okay. I don't know what my job is here, though.
To indulge my everywhere. Ray Harryhausen? Okay, I'll tell you why. First of all, the kind of work that he does in filmmaking, for me, crystallizes what is most purely magical about cinema. I mean, the entire illusion is based on the persistence of vision. The 24 frames a second, although that may change in the future, creating the illusion of movement. And there's something magical about stop motion that exploits that very function of cinema to create the illusion of movement with objects that are not moving on their own. So there's a magic to it, there's an alchemy to it. This is an alchemy that was first practiced by the likes of Georges Méliès, the great French filmmaker who helped originate the art form and was really the first one to explore its fullest expressionistic possibilities. So for me, Ray Harryhausen is one of the great magicians of cinema. He was a master craftsman, a great artist. It takes almost a genius to be able to work with the tools, the myriad of tools that he had to concoct to pull off the work that he did. But it's his influence on other filmmakers that I'm really honouring here with this Glasball Award. This man launched an entire generation of filmmakers. Guys like Joe Dante, guys like John Landis, guys like Tim Burton. People who, when they were kids, were completely spellbound by his work and were inspired to go into cinema and became some of the most creative, dynamic and innovative filmmakers of the post-Harryhausen generation. So for his influence on cinema, for the fact that he practices his craft at a level that can never be surpassed, and even for the fact that what he did has almost become a lost art form, I can't think of too many more people more fully deserving of the award, of the honour, of Cinephobiac of the Century. Except for the other guy who won.
The second winner is Roger Corman. Also still alive.
Also still alive. Another reason why we Coma. Now, he just won the Academy Award. Finally, they gave him an Academy Award after many decades when they should have honored him a long time ago. Well, finally, he won the Academy Award. But I'm sure once he gets his hand on a Glazzy, or maybe an email letting him know he won a Glazzy, he'll realize that the Academy Award was just a runner-up to the greatest honor a filmmaker could ever possibly achieve in the world of cinema, a glass ball.
So why did you pick Roger Corman for this award then?
There's actually a very specific reason why. Not just the fact that he's still alive, not just the fact that he's produced hundreds of movies, not just for the fact that he's launched gazillions of careers, but there's two really main categories why Roger Corman deserves this award. First of all, Roger Corman should be the ideal film producer of the current century, because his mentality was he knew how to exploit cinema, he knew how to exploit trends in cinema, but he did it intelligently. He not only jumped on trends and got product out very quickly and knew how to pre-sell his films and knew how to make money before he started rolling celluloid on any one of his given productions, he did films with a certain visionary perspective. Even the most corniest of his films, or the cheapest of his films, generally have some underlying redeeming quality to them, an intelligence, a subversion, a social commentary. He kind of, for me, epitomizes the ideal exploitation filmmaker who knows how to fully and aggressively throw stuff into the marketplace while simultaneously creating art. I think we need to revisit some of his practices and some of his methodologies and some of his ideologies. Now, there's another reason. Corman has long been credited for launching spectacular careers in the film business. We all know the likes of Francis Ford Coppola. He helped launch the career of
Jonathan Demme,
Joe Dante, Martin Scorsese, Ron Howard, and even actors like Jack Nicholson, Bruce Dern. And not only that, all sorts of people behind the scenes, writers, producers, a lot of future studio heads all came through the Roger Corman school, and that's what they call it. He's like an institution. It was almost a rite of passage at a certain point that you worked for Corman at one point and then you went on to a successful career in the film business. So he's often credited for having an eye for talent. And while I don't dispute that, I have come to the conclusion it wasn't necessarily the idea of Corman finding all this great latent talent in guys like Copeland, Dante, and Jonathan Demme. Roger Corman created them. He turned them into filmmakers. A large part of their success is based upon their tutelage under Corman. Often when he gave filmmakers their first chance to direct a feature, he'd sit down with them for 2 hours and give them the Roger Corman Film School speech. Many of those directors still cite those lessons as coming into focus for them years later when they were making big, gigantic Hollywood A-list pictures. Ron Howard talks about running up the side of a hill trying to photograph Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman as the sun was going down in one of his shots and realizing, God, I remember this. Roger Corman told me how to utilize the sun this way. Jonathan Demme wasn't even aspiring to be a filmmaker. He was like a publicist or something, and Corman saw in him the potential to direct a film, and he trained him and unleashed him on the world. He basically helped give birth to one of the most idiosyncratic, original, vivacious American filmmakers of the last 20 years or whatever. All Roger Corman. Not just an eye for talent, but the ability to nurture talent and the ability to create enduring talent. Francis Ford Coppola would not have been Francis Ford Coppola without Roger Corman. And I think even he would acknowledge that.